Monday, March 19th, 2007, at 2 o'clock, House Committee on Judiciary.
I'll call to order a meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for the Oregon Legislature for Monday, March 19, 2007. We're in a different location than we're accustomed to, but it's a great location here in Alloy, and my Vice Chair, Representative Barker's district, and we appreciate his hospitality and hosting us here. We're coming to learn more about a very important topic. The Internet has sent waves of change rolling through all aspects of how we live. One part of modern life that's all been altered by the Internet is crime. And this should come as no surprise to us. A century ago, the automobile transformed American life and how criminals prey on their victims. The ability to drive up to a bank or a store, hold it up for a bag of cash, and then disappear into the anonymous flow of traffic changed society in a way that created new threats. The Internet presents a whole new set of dangers. It gives total anonymity to the criminal, which is especially frightening when he's a sexual predator. Our teenagers have no way to be sure that the new friend they met online is, as claimed, another teenager struggling with the natural stresses of growing up. Too often it's a 30-year-old male engaging in what law enforcement experts call grooming. He befriends the teen, waiting until defenses are lowered, and then proposes a face-to-face meeting. The purpose of our hearing today is to learn more about this danger created by the Internet and to find out what we as legislators can do about it. We came here to Alloa High School so the information we receive will fit into its natural context. It is middle school and high school students who are targeted by Internet predators. I'd like to thank the Beaverton Public Schools and particularly Maureen Wheeler of the school district for making this space available. I'd also like to recognize Kalia Ferguson, vice principal of the Alloa High School, who helped make the arrangements as well. We're going to hear from a series of panels, and so I'd like to invite the first of those panels forward. And this will consist of Carrie Tomlinson of a Fox investigative reporter, Xavier Von Erk of Perverted Justice, Detective Travis Goldberg of the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, and Pam Treptow, who has a victim in her family. If you'll come forward to the witness table we have here, those four of you. And as you come forward, let me just note some, I think, some statistics that are important to know. 65% of American children use the Internet, and a 2000 U.S. Department of Justice survey determined that of youths aged 10 to 17, 1 in 5 had received a sexual solicitation or approach over the Internet in the preceding year. This problem has been showcased by the media and by activists, such as we're about to hear from, who have set up sting operations to identify the kind of people who are engaging in this terrible kind of conduct. So I'd now like to open it up for our first panelist, Carrie Tomlinson of Fox.
That's right. I need to read the cheat sheet to know what I'm supposed to say. Chair McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Carrie Tomlinson, and I'm a reporter with Channel 12 News. And we have done 4 of these cyber stings that you all may or may not have seen. Have you seen any of them? The Channel 12 ones, not the Dateline ones? Not that the Dateline ones aren't great, but specifically ours are a little bit different. We started out doing the first one in 2004, and we worked with Xavier from Perverted Justice, Xavier Von Erk, and I had never heard of this happening before 2004, until our sister station in Kansas City, I believe, worked with Perverted Justice, and then it was assigned to me to do the same thing here. And I didn't see any of the stories from Kansas City except for one small clip, and all I saw was a transcript of part of the conversation that had taken place between an adult male and someone whom the adult male believed to be a young teen. And I thought it was a joke. I said, how could someone sit down at a computer, an adult, and write something so lewd to someone he thought was a 12 or 13-year-old girl? I thought, this is a joke. He would never write it down. That puts it into the record. But as it turns out, from doing that story and working with Xavier, we found that hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people do this all the time. So we set up an operation. At that time, Xavier called them media busts. And I don't know if you still call them that, but it's a little different now, I suppose. But this was our first media bust. And what we did it over Valentine's Day weekend in 2004. And we rented a house, and Xavier and some of his co-workers, co-volunteers, came over and in one of the bedrooms set up a host of computers and went online in the chat rooms. And in basically 24 hours, more or less, 2 days, 12 adults came over. And it seems they really did want to have sex with children. So I'm going to show you now one of the people who came to our door that day. We have a story to show you from 2004.
He went by the name Jamil, 6 foot one, 225 pounds, knocking on a young teen's door for sex.
He was brutal. He was a big guy.
Jeff is his date, posing as 13-year-old Amy online.
A little 13-year-old girl, that it appalled me to think that what damage she could actually do to a young girl.
But there is far more to this man than even Jeff imagined. He was raised in Sweet Home, Oregon. People there say he was a sweet child, smart and respectful. But Richard Germaine Howard moved to Portland as a teen, and everything changed. Police reports from 1990 show he was a gang member known as OZ. One night, he built Molotov cocktails with a female friend, then firebombed a rival gang member's house in North Portland. That same night, the female friend called the rival to her house. Richard was hiding in the shadows and shot him. The rival staggered into the street, his house in shambles. He never got up. Richard ran.
Who's it?
14 years later, Richard Germaine Howard shows up here after spending years behind bars for the murder. He was ready for a good time. He was not ready for this.
Hey, I'm that little girl you were talking to in the internet, huh? You still want to drink some beer with me?
That ain't what I'm here for.
Well, what you got there?
Again, he ran, dropping his package as he climbed the fence. Why did 4 bottles of beer for his 13-year-old date?
It scares me because what if...
Many people who know Richard Germaine Howard don't want to talk on camera, some out of fear. This woman says her young granddaughter lived in the same house as he did a few years back.
He's very kind to them, so to say he was doing this is scary for me.
Richard moved out of his North Portland apartment soon after running from our cameras. But his father still lives in town. His name is Richard Howard as well, and he too has a past. At age 56, he forced sex on a girl in her late teens. Now, he's over 70 and is very sick. Still, he loves his son.
The only thing I can say, he's a good kid, and what went wrong. I don't know how it happened or when it happened.
He says the shooting in 1990 was a setup. The underage date, he adds, is out of character for Richard, who had all the dates he wanted.
Women came to him. A dime a dozen. He just, go out with him and that was it.
His father wonders, where will Richard go now and how will he survive? Why are you here? Others hope getting caught will force him to change.
I think of how I would feel if this was my child that somebody was hitting on. And I don't want this guy or any of these other guys preying on our children.
So, luckily, most of the people who have come to our houses in the 4 times we've done this have not been convicted murderers. He was the only one that I know of. And he was also the only one where I was physically frightened when I opened the door. I didn't know about his background when I opened the door, but when I opened the door and saw him, I was scared. The rest of them, it's like, yeah, I can take him. But that guy, no. So What changed after doing this twice with Perverted Justice is local law enforcement had been interested in this for some time and contacted us, and the first was Multnomah County in November of last year, and the second was Clackamas County in February of this year. And we'll show you the story from one of our people from November. And what I personally really enjoy about it is knowing that when that guy runs off, now that law enforcement is involved, he's going to be caught. The first guy, I don't know where Richard Howard is. I don't know what he's doing. We didn't have law enforcement involved. They didn't want to work with us at that time. Actually, I shouldn't say the local law enforcement didn't want to work with us. They did, but at that time we had difficulties getting things figured out on how to make that happen. So here's an example of what happens now that law enforcement is involved. And actually, I said this was from November with Multnomah County, but I'm sorry, it is actually from February with Clackamas County.
Hey, Alan.
Under arrest for the bag, sir. Police officer.
Alan's try at a one-night stand will end on a hard cot in the Clackamas County Jail. He's 43, a father of two young boys, a project engineer designing roads for the state of Oregon. But detectives say Alan Grabinski was planning something much more devious, an evening of sex with a young teen in Wilsonville. "You'll probably think this is nasty," he wrote. "I like talking about it." The 13-year-old girl is really an adult, a man, Paul Farnstrom, with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, waiting to catch predators online. "I'll tell you what I like," he said. "I like to continue to kiss, going down." Detectives say Alan continued the conversation on the phone with an adult decoy, telling her what else he wanted to do with the girl.
"I'd drive by and then head down towards Wilsonville Road."
Then he was ready, driving to her home in Wilsonville, parking the car, coming to the door, stepping inside. Alan showed the girl pictures and said he raced in half marathons.
"You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against the court."
So the arrest team was ready too, in case Alan tried to run. No need.
Alan, I'm Carrie Tomlinson with Fox 12 News.
Now Alan Grabinski is quiet.
"My question for you is what brought you here today?"
So we speak to him.
"Live in Beaverton. You brought things in your bag. One of them appears to be a sex toy. What else was in the bag?"
"You brought tequila for a 13-year-old girl.
And you have children. Young children.
You have a lot on the line. But you'll give all that up for this?"
Still no answer. So then it was time to go for a ride to the station for a talk with a detective.
"Alan, do you have anything to say to your family?"
And for a night alone in jail.
So that was our experience, and what we had to learn along the way, by the way, just with that last story, is we couldn't show the really graphic things that they said online on television because it got so many complaints. But suffice it to say that they have not stopped writing very lewd things online to people they believe are 13-year-old children. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tomlinson. Mr. Von Erk.
Thank you. Chair McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Xavier Von Erk of the group PervertedJustice.com. I'm the founder and director of operations. We started going into chat rooms posing as 10 to 15-year-old males and females in middle of 2003. We did so very simply because the problem we saw while as chatters ourselves was immense. And we saw that in the Oregon chat rooms themselves. We saw them in the Portland rooms and the Oregon rooms. From there, we've gone on a journey that we didn't really quite expect. We started out thinking that we'd just expose some guys and they'd stop going into the rooms. Somewhat naive looking back, but that's the thought process we went in with. We didn't really understand the full scope of the problem, as most people didn't in that time period. Since then, over the last 3.5 years, we've had over 170 people convicted. We've had around 500 arrested, and most of those are still pending trial. And we've worked across the entire country. Most of you probably have seen our shows with Dateline NBC called To Catch a Predator. They air periodically, and they feature, much like Carrie Stang's, individuals coming to a house, being interviewed, and then being arrested. For us, our experience has been much more in-depth than most people. We see these conversations every single day, and we see the entire conversation, not edited for TV and not for people's sensibilities. We post them on our website, perverted-justice.com, and we try to expose the reality of Internet predators to the public. And by the reality, I don't mean, you know, that you think, oh, the guy showed up, he had a sexual conversation. We're talking everything. These individuals are practiced at using the technology of today to try to corrupt the youth. Some of them use webcams in various grotesque ways. They are all sexually explicit in every single way you can imagine. The thing that's really shocked us, though, is just how deep the problem is with some of these people. Getting an arrest sometimes isn't the end of the story. We've had about a dozen people so far that we've already gotten arrested hit on us again. Waiting trial, in most cases. One individual was convicted. His name was Kevin Westerbeck in Ohio. He was convicted of the crime and sentenced to 9 months in jail. They gave him a week to take care of his personal affairs, to put them in order. In that time, he hit on us and showed up at another house and was arrested yet again. That just shows how deep and depraved these people are. They will continue to come again and again as long as they don't fear the consequences of their actions. Over the years, we've amassed a long record of working with the media and law enforcement in the last couple of years, and we've seen the results just basically astound us. These individuals are your everyday person. They're your gardener, the guy next door. You never know who these individuals are. No longer do people think that this crime is limited to the Hollywood archetype of the short, balding, glasses individual. They now know it's sometimes the rabbi, it's sometimes the priest. That's how prevalent this problem is. I'm going to keep my remarks somewhat brief because, quite frankly, there's a lot of people you have to hear from today. I'll leave you with one sobering fact. No chat room I've gone in, or none of our, or any of our volunteers have ever gone in, have we not been hit on. Every single time we've gone into an Oregon chat room, a Portland chat room, or any other chat room across this country, we have always received some sort of solicitation, whether it's aggressive, passive, or it's just a person with a webcam. That's how deep the problem is, and that's the reality of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Von Erich. We're going to hold off on questions for this panel until after we've heard from all four of you, and then there'll be an opportunity for other members to ask questions. But I did want to express our appreciation for what the energy and creativity you've brought to dealing, identifying this problem, and then working on one particular way of exposing the people who are perpetrating this offense. Detective Goldberg.
Yeah, thank you very much. Chairman McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Travis Goldberg. I'm a detective with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. I don't know how much more I can add to the other two speakers as they eloquently put and are trying to put forth this issue. I can tell you that I had an opportunity to participate in two cyber stings as a law enforcement officer. It was very rewarding to know that something is being done about this issue. In those two missions, a total of 10 people were arrested from North Carolina to India to locally. Also during those two missions, well over 100 different contacts were made on a total of 6 days. Many of those were innocent, however, a good portion of them led to explicit pictures being sent to our undercover operators, to talking about or engaging in talk regarding sexual intercourse, to many of them agreeing at some point during the conversation to meet with our undercover operators. Unfortunately, many of them didn't come to our sting house, but of the 10 that did, I think that it was a good thing. It was a good partnership between the media and the law enforcement to finally do something about this issue. And rather than go into continuing on with the topics that they've already covered, the one thing I'll leave you with is, as a police officer, the most frustrating part was at the state level, for charges, we're looking at attempt charges, and it made it very difficult to investigate these crimes and to feel good about the final outcome, hopefully in most cases a conviction, where an individual will be discharged with an attempt crime, maybe see probation. Well, initially how I came to be involved, Carrie's asking me to ask why I wanted to be involved. I have kids of my own. I have an 11-year-old and a 9-year-old. And when I saw Perverted Justice on TV, probably about a year and a half prior to us getting involved with Box 12 to do the first mission, it became evident that I needed to do something locally, as I saw the two previous missions that Box 12 had done without law enforcement, and it concerned me that these individuals were able to walk away, and I thought that there had to be something done with law enforcement to be able to act upon these individuals who show up to the sting house. But even more importantly, it's to protect our children. But again, I'd just like to stress that anything that can be done to help investigators get some kind of teeth on a law that gets these individuals not just with attempt crimes, but an actual crime, I think that would benefit law enforcement in general. Thank you.
Thank you, Detective Goldberg, and thank you for your commitment to this issue. Let's hear from the fourth panelist now. Pam Trepto is the mother of a victim of an internet predator.
Yes, and we're going to show a story that is relevant to Pam's situation. I think I'm supposed to say Chair McPherson. We are going to show a story. But this is actually extremely significant and kind of just makes this all real. This was from our very first cyber sting in 2004 with Perverted Justice. 12 people showed up. There was a 13th man who never showed up. And we waited around an extra night. It was a Sunday night, the weekend of Valentine's Day. And we all waited that night, waited into the night, because he said he was going to come after he refed his children's basketball game. He's a child basketball ref and a special ed teacher's aide in Salem. And he said he wanted to do his basketball game and then come visit the girl at our house. And he sent her pictures. Well, he never showed up. And as it turns out, several months later, he became involved online with Pam's daughter. So we'd like to show you this story, which is an interview with Pam's daughter about what had happened, but it's an example of what happens when you don't catch him.
This spring, she says, David Arthur Hills of Salem brought her to his apartment where they had sex. She met him in a chat room, then in person. She says he made her feel like he cared for her in a special way.
If you hate something about yourself or you feel like insecure about something, you can somehow figure it out. Like, he'll totally compliment you on it. He said that I have, like, great skin and like, really pretty hair and just, yeah.
David Hills was a basketball referee and a camp counselor for kids.
He asked me if he could kiss me. I just, like, started cracking up laughing. It's just, like, really awkward. And then, like, he asked me again when the last time I was kissed, and then, like, he just kissed me.
He worked as a teacher's assistant at West Salem High School in a special ed classroom.
He asked me to sleep with him, like, the first time I was actually with him alone. And I said no, and he asked me again, and I said no, and again, and I said no.
But Sarah says David was persistent. So, while David worked with special needs kids during the day, Sarah says he spent time off the job with her, performing sexual activities.
And I'd asked him before if it would just be like a one-night stand or whatever. He's like, no, it wouldn't be. He used me.
It did not last. According to Sarah, David told her he was falling for someone else.
I cried, literally. He knew it was wrong.
Sarah's best friend, 15-year-old Savannah, wanted to support her friend.
And the sad thing is we knew it was wrong, too, and we still went along with it.
And so we're entering a not guilty plea at this time.
Now, David Hills is facing charges of statutory rape and sodomy. Sarah is struggling to understand how she lost so much to a stranger from the Internet.
Don't do it. It's not worth it. No matter what they say, don't do it.
What part is
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Pam, and that was quite... Excuse me. She had a really hard time for a while. She used to be an A and B student, and her grades went down to D's and F's. And she was engaging in some real self-destructive behavior, and she talked about wanting to die, and she was seeing a counselor and a psychiatrist, and she was on antidepressants, and she's never been the same since he got a hold of her. Today she's doing better, but it took a long time, and she's still never been the same. He used to... She was 14 the first time they were together. The week before her 15th birthday, he used to pick her up at the public library and take her over to his apartment, and things happened there, and she finally came to me and with her friend, because she just couldn't handle the pressure anymore, and she told me what happened, and then I called the police and they went and got him. He only received a year in jail and 4 years probation. And he had to pay $1,000 towards her counseling, and I don't think that was near enough for what he put her through. She had a really hard time.
Explain how she's doing now.
Today, just this year, her grades have started coming back up. She's due to graduate in June, and she's living on her own and doing really well. And she's been in contact with me every now and then, just being closer and communicating more.
And you're going to be a grandma.
And she's got a real good boyfriend right now that's her age. And they're planning on getting married, and they're expecting their first child in June.
Ms. Trento, thank you very much for coming. You know how painful this is and how difficult, but it's the experience you're describing puts a human dimension on this problem that I think is really critical, and I think will help us focus public attention on something that really needs to get more attention. What I'd like to do is open it up for questions for this panel, and I'm going to lead off with a question for Mr. Von Erk. Given that the Internet is a national or even international medium, and yet the crimes as they play out are performed locally, how do the predators then narrow down when they're on the internet so that they are going after victims who are physically close by?
Chairman McPherson, Representative McPherson.
Number one spot.
How they narrow it down is pretty simple. Most.
Just a reminder that there is a tape at this spot tonight.
All right. How they narrow it down is pretty simple. Most services, such as Yahoo, AOL, even MySpace, have rooms by location. For example, on Yahoo, there's two very bad ones. One's Romance Oregon. The other one is Regional Portland. They go into those rooms, and they know that anybody knows that that area is either in Oregon or in Portland. And also, of things like just MySpace, you can search by location, you can search by age, and you can search by name. So there's a myriad of ways that they can actually narrow it down to people in their area.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr., is it Vanner? My question is also for you, and it has to do with the chat rooms that you mentioned, and you said something about Yahoo, and I have teenagers, so I know a little bit about these things, but I'd like to know a lot more. Are there particular places that are safer than others? I know that sometimes with some of these, there are controls that they can put on so that only people they know can get in, and privacy things that the companies are doing, but is that helping or not?
Chairman McPherson, Representative Bonamici.
There you go.
Not really with chat rooms. With chat rooms, there's no safe way to use a chat room, especially on major services such as AOL and Yahoo. There are, of course, software options that you can put onto your computer to know what your child is doing online, keyloggers and other things that can restrict where they go to, but there's no way to really sanitize the Internet on these major services in chat rooms and on social networking websites like MySpace.com. And livejournal.com. So while you can lock your kid out of certain parts of the Internet, there's no way to really clean it up in that manner.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I guess for definitional purposes, if you said social networking, that would be like MySpace or LiveJournal or Facebook. Then chat rooms are, is there an infinite number of these, or are there certain popular sites or something that we should be wary of? Or how
there are certain popular websites that people need to be wary of. Anything large that attracts a lot of attention. Really, any chat room in particular. A chat room is an area where everyone logs into a common place and they can see every message that everyone is typing in this main screen. And there are, of course, software options that you can put onto your computer to know what your child is doing online, keyloggers and other things that can restrict where they go to, but there's no way to really sanitize the Internet on these major services in chat rooms and on social networking websites like MySpace.com and LiveJournal.com. So while you can lock your kid out of certain parts of the Internet, there's no way to really clean it up in that manner.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I guess for definitional purposes, if you said social networking, that would be like MySpace or LiveJournal or Facebook. Then chat rooms are, is there an infinite number of these, or are there certain popular sites or something that we should be wary of? Or how?
There are certain popular websites that people need to be wary of. Anything large that attracts a lot of attention. Really, any chat room in particular. A chat room is an area where everyone logs into a common place and they can see every message that everyone is typing in this main screen. And then there's a user list on the right. And on that user list, they can initiate a private conversation. So if you have a 13-year-old girl that goes into, say, Regional Portland, she's seen by 50 other people who, in most cases, are not good individuals. Social networking website is more of a blog, you know, a journal type system where people can sign up as friends and then read what you're doing. And so it's a small difference.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? And thank you very much. I appreciate the all the work that all of you are doing in your different capacities, and appreciate Ms. Trepto coming and presenting her story. Our next panel will be focusing on law enforcement efforts. I'd like to invite Bill Carroll from the Oregon Department of Justice, Sergeant Josh Moulin from Central Point Police Department, Lieutenant Andy Schroeder from the Regional Forensics Crime Lab from Hillsborough Police Department, and Detective Gary Wright from the Washington County Sheriff's Office. We're aware that it's not just the sting operation format that's gotten the publicity and around ways of catching these predators. It needs to be a sort of a multi-dimensional effort to try and combat this problem, so we want to learn more about it from this panel. Mr. Carroll.
Good afternoon, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Bill Carroll. I'm the chief investigator with the Oregon Department of Justice, Criminal Justice Division, and in that capacity, I serve as the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force Commander. You'll hear me refer to it as ICAC, and several other members will call it ICAC, ICAC. I'd like to spend a few minutes talking to the committee about what the Oregon ICAC Task Force is and what it does. To meet the challenge of protecting kids in the new world created by the Internet, that is a world with no physical or political boundaries, we in law enforcement have had to evolve. We had to find better ways of working together, better ways of communicating. It was with these goals in mind that the ICAC program was created. The ICAC program is a national network of federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies. Today there are over 46 task forces that span the nation. It is through the kind of partnerships created by the ICAC task force that law enforcement will be most effective in exposing and prosecuting those who use the Internet to seek out and solicit children for sex. The Oregon ICAC Task Force was created in 2004. It's funded by a federal grant that pays for two criminal investigators, one of which is a computer forensic examiner. You'll get a chance to see both of those investigators on panel number five today. The task force is housed at the Criminal Justice Division at the Oregon Department of Justice, and in addition to the two investigators funded through the grant, DOJ dedicates some of its own internal staff. An Assistant Attorney General, Michael Slauson, who will be here today, a support person, and myself. These members provide legal and administrative support to the task force. Oregon's ICAC task force has the distinction of being the only ICAC in the nation to have affiliate agents in every single county. They include district attorneys, local, state, and federal law enforcement, and we've also signed up tribal police as an affiliates. Statewide, we have 134 agencies that have signed formal MOUs with the ICAC. Each affiliate agency has formally pledged to cooperate across jurisdictional boundaries in investigations, prosecution, and educational efforts. Through the task force affiliates, they receive training and act as educational resources in their community, reaching out to schools, parents, and community organizations. Later in today's testimony, ICAC task force investigators will show you the kinds of materials that they are using to teach students, teachers, and parents about how to keep children out of harm's way while they are online. The Oregon ICAC serves as a link between its affiliate agencies, local, state, and federal affiliates of each of the other 45 ICACs across the country. This network allows us to share information about victims and suspects with our counterparts in other states, which is key to achieving our collective goal of preventing online sexual exploitation of children. One important aspect of the ICAC's mission is the enforcement of criminal laws. As part of that function, the Oregon ICAC has established uniform standards for investigations, including undercover operations. Each affiliate agency has committed to using the same nationally recognized ICAC protocol in conducting investigations and gathering evidence. By adhering to uniform investigative techniques and guidelines, we do our best to ensure that none of these important cases slip through our fingers. The Oregon ICAC is also the state's clearinghouse for tips that come in through the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children about predators and their victims living in Oregon. We pass these tips along to the agencies with authority to follow up, then are available to assist those agencies in the ensuing investigation and the prosecution, including assisting with forensic examinations of the computers and associated equipment. I'll share one case example that was worked on by the ICAC. This is by no means all-encompassing because we've had several since 2004. One of them was a case involving an individual named Mike Yarnell who lived up in the Mill City area. The tip came in through the National Center to Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, about an online solicitation of a 13-year-old girl. By tracking the tip back, we were contacted by Broken Arrow, Oklahoma Police Department, and identified Mr. Yarnell up in Mill City. What had happened was the 13-year-old girl was chatting online with Mr. Yarnell. He sent a picture of himself, or what was purported to be a picture of him, which was a 19-year-old boy with his shirt off and a six-pack stomach. The 13-year-old girl responded to him and engaged in numerous conversations, including sending sexually explicit photographs of herself. She was eventually it was found by her father, who was going through their family computer looking for some Pinewood Derby plans with his son, the folder of his daughter engaging in these sexually explicit photos. The Yarnell case highlights the need for and the effectiveness of a cooperative law enforcement response to the problem of online child exploitation. We've had a number of other cases that involved out-of-state contact with children in Oregon. On behalf of the Oregon ICAC, thank you for the opportunity to address the committee. We very much appreciate your interest and support of the new laws that better capture the kind of activity sex offenders are engaging in online and that provide tougher state sentences. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Now, Sergeant Mullen.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Josh Mullen. I'm a sergeant with the Central Point Police Department. And Central Point is in southern Oregon down by Medford, if you're not familiar with the little city that I come from. But our population is about 16,500. The reason I'm here is to discuss, of course, the internet problems that we're having with criminals in specifically southern Oregon. And I have a little bit of a PowerPoint presentation and a video myself. So if you'll excuse me, I'm going to stand up and go over to my computer. Just a little bit of background on myself. I started as a patrol officer and working on the streets. I went up into the detective division working specifically high-tech crimes. In 2005, the Central Point Police Department started a high-tech crimes unit to do nothing but the investigation of computer-related crimes and internet crimes. After a couple years of doing that in 2007, we started the High-Tech Crimes Task Force of Southern Oregon, and we now have a detective from the Medford Police Department assigned to our office full-time because of the amount of cases we were seeing. We're extremely busy in both reactive and proactive investigations in Southern Oregon. Some background on myself as far as training and experience. I was trained by the International Association of Computer Investigative Specialists, also known as IASIS, and am currently one of approximately 630 worldwide certified forensic computer examiners. I've also been trained by agencies such as the United States Army, ICAP, we're a part of them, Access Data, the National White Collar Crime Center, and other organizations in internet crime. In Central Point, we have a complete forensics laboratory, and just because of this problem that we're seeing, we can conduct computer investigations on internet crimes specifically, as well as other crimes, and we do forensics for agencies such as the FBI, ICE, DEA, the Oregon State Police, and then we have memorandums of agreement with multiple law enforcement agencies all over the state of Oregon, from Klamath area to the Oregon coast and other places. This is just a couple of photographs of our lab so you can see kind of what we're working with and the things that we're doing. And some of the investigations that I wanted to talk about briefly, two of our high-profile investigations that we've had in Southern Oregon, you'll see the pictures of two of them down there. One on the left is Mark Ray Daly, and the person on the right is Greg Thompson. Now, we perform reactive investigations, like I said, where an agency or ourselves will have another crime that involves computers, and we will examine the computers for evidence. But we also do proactive online investigations such as peer-to-peer software where people are trading child pornography via the internet, or they are chatting online with us as undercover agents doing that, or we'll take over an account from somebody in our area. We currently have a 100% conviction rate for every person that we have arrested for internet crimes. Mr. Doty on the left lived in Central Point. We received a tip that he was chatting online with minors, and we ended up arresting him. He had hundreds of images of child pornography on his computer, as well as we found chat after chat of him posing as an Oregon State Police trooper. And he would chat with the children, and he would say, I would like you to perform these various sex acts on your webcam. And then when they refused, he would say, well, I'm a trooper with the Oregon State Police. If you do not do this, I'm going to have a police officer at your door. You'll be arrested. We'll seize your computers, and we'll tell your parents everything that you're doing online. And so the children would comply. And so we received, on his computer, we found all of these webcam videos of the children performing sex acts. And these are from 11 years old all the way up to 16, and we did identify some of these children. Mr. Thompson on the right-hand side, he came from a cyber tip. He had over 1,100 images of child pornography on his computer. He also owned a business in Medford where he was videotaping his female juvenile employees using the restroom within his business, that we found evidence of that when we did the exam on his computer. This is a video of our local news station, KTVL, watching some of the problems that we were having in chat rooms in Southern Oregon.
Whether your children are surfing the internet behind closed doors or right in plain view, keeping track of who they're chatting with online can be nearly impossible. Software programs that filter what children can see on the internet might block obscene words but not chatting. And while kids may think they're talking with someone their own age, may actually be an adult sexual predator. Tonight we go undercover with Central Point Police to show you what's being talked about on these sites and who may be chatting up your kids. We want to warn you, some of this material is graphic. Meet Julie CHS 600. Not who you might expect with that screen name. His real name, Detective Josh Mullen.
I'm going to find out how old this guy is. He just said, wow, you sound hot. You have nice legs.
Detective Mullen has agreed to let us watch as he goes undercover as a 14-year-old girl online. In one chat room, he's Julie CHS 600. In another, he's Soccer Julie 6. It's a technique used by police to hone in on sexual predators who are interested in far more than a quick chat.
I'm not engaging them in their conversation. I'm letting them control the conversation. So they'll ask me questions, and I'll just give general responses or just not respond at all or say something that would not lead them to believe I'm interested and just see what they do. And every one of these people so far has come back anyway, even though I haven't really shown much interest and said what they would like to do to me or if they can call me if I want to have cyber sex or phone sex with them.
Screen name I Love Girls Feet wants to know if Soccer Julie is wearing cute socks. After a simple answer, his part of the conversation immediately turns sexual. Another chatter, Smack 311, claims to be 18 and has no problem with Julie being just 14. He's interested in sex. Mullen says the request for a phone number is often the first ploy in arranging a face-to-face meeting.
You want to have cyber sex or phone sex. A lot of these people will want to call and talk to you on the phone because they want to confirm that you really are who you say you are. I predict that if we were to engage this person and answer the questions he wants us to, it'll probably get fairly graphic pretty quickly.
And he's right. By now, a long list of chatters are lined up to talk, all male, all wanting one thing. Surely, Z58 begins by asking about Julie's sexual past.
A 20-some-year-old guy talking to a 14-year-old about this. It's pretty scary.
Others get right to the point. The conversations get more and more explicit, again, with no encouragement from Detective Mullen. Some even send pictures, lewd pictures that are illegal to send to children. Like this one, we had to almost completely block out. Mullen says it's all part of the thing to entice and convince children to take the bait and meet in person.
And also offered on these chat sites are free passwords for XXX websites. The good news, Central Point Police have new software to track those predators. Their cybercrime unit is getting ready to go after predators in our area, those who come to our area for sexual encounters with children. But they say parents educating their own kids is key.
That's just an example of something that we do on a fairly regular basis in Central Point. And one of the reasons that I wanted to come up here and have the opportunity to talk is just to show that this is not a Portland problem or a Northern Oregon problem. This is happening widespread, and we're having these problems in Southern Oregon just as frequently. And I'm going to echo what the detective in the last panel said. Our major frustration, the two cases I showed you, Mr. Doty is still awaiting sentencing, but Mr. Thompson received 18 months of probation, no jail time whatsoever for his crimes. And what we're finding is we are having to arrest him for attempted sex abuse or attempted sodomy or something like that, which are lesser crimes, and we're having to show that they took substantial steps to commit some of these crimes. So having some sort of legislation that would include specific internet crimes would be extremely helpful in the investigations of the crimes that we're seeing.
Okay. Thank you, Sergeant Mullen. Next, we'll hear from Lieutenant Schroeder.
Thank you, Representative McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Andy Schroeder. I'm a lieutenant with the Hillsborough Police Department. I'm also the operations manager at the Northwest Regional Computer Forensics Laboratory located in Portland. The RCFL in Portland is an intergovernmental agency established by administrative rule and memorandums of understanding between contributing agencies. Right now, those agencies that contribute staff to the RCFL are the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the Oregon State Police, the Washington County Sheriff's Department, Multnomah County Sheriff's Department, Clark County Sheriff's Department in Washington, the cities of Portland, Beaverton, Gresham, and Hillsborough. Our main objective in our laboratory is basically to process digital evidence, and that includes just about any digital evidence that you could well imagine. I kind of like the old Marine Corps saying, if you have it, we can process it. If we can't process it, we'll find somebody to process it. And if we can't find somebody to process it, it's very likely that it can't be processed. It sounded much better in my head than it did out loud. I was asked by Mr. Stanford to come and talk to you today about what we do, and it would probably glass over your eyes if I went into any great detail. The problems that we face with digital evidence are the sheer volume. I'll kind of show you what I mean. These are devices that maybe you've seen. These are all thumb drives. This is a 4 gigabyte thumb drive. This is my favorite because it's theoretically the biggest. This is a 2 gigabyte thumb drive. I just keep my important programs on this one. This is kind of my storage one. I have my backup 1 gigabyte in case I got to throw down, that kind of thing. I have my iPod. This holds 250 songs. I think it's like 2 gigabytes of data. I've got my phones. You all probably have cell phones, right? You know about those. They can take pictures. They can hold messages, all sorts of things. And to even make matters worse, I have a PDA phone because I can't be, whoever dies with the most toys really wins. So I have this. Those are all of the devices, and that doesn't count what I have in my car. I've got more, believe me. And if you notice, people with laptops here, literally representing millions and millions of bits of data. It also represents hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of photo images that can be stored and kept on any one of these devices. Any of these devices could have child pornography in them. Any of these devices can be used to further, if you will, the crimes of possession of pornography or any other actual criminal activity. We face in the laboratory a growing tide of data overwhelming. I started 9 months ago. We never saw what we call a terabyte case, which is a large data set. Now we've seized seven computer systems just in the past few months that will have over a terabyte of data, which represents, again, hundreds of thousands of images that are contained on these devices that have to be examined before a charge can be made. Currently, you'll probably hear from the attorneys that they've set a number of images that they need to find to prosecute. It could be 300, it can be 600, what have you. We have to go through that evidence, and investigators have to go through that evidence to find those images to be able to make those charges. And as the amount, the sheer volume of images goes up, it takes time to process a computer. George Houston in the back has a laptop. I know because we bought it. It's a 120 gigabyte drive. George, can you hold up your laptop, please? Don't drop it. Is he holding it up? It's an Apple. It's kind of a plug, shameless as it is. To process that machine, because I have one just like it. I've done it. It takes almost 16 hours to image, copy the drive, and then index it for processing. And that's pretty quick, but it's 16 hours. And as you can well imagine, that can be 2 or 3 days just to get the device ready to be examined, to be looked at, and processed for evidence. And that by no means is necessarily the average computer that we're seeing come into the lab today. It's a huge issue for law enforcement. How do we deal with this volume of data, and how do we get that information to the investigators who really are the ones that need it to be able to deal with it? It simply takes time, and I don't see that necessarily changing. When I had an opportunity to talk to Mr. Stanford about the legislation that's proposed that this committee is considering, I was relieved in one sense to think that this law would help law enforcement deal with these people who, as you can see, are doing, you know, hideous and shocking things, in my view, by being able to make charges immediately and allow some relief, certainly on the evidentiary side, of processing things. Our goal in the lab, and of these forensic examiners, they'll tell you, we absolutely want to put the best evidence forward to court so that these people are convicted and get whatever punishment the judges or whoever feels appropriate, but that takes time. And the law and the laws that Mr. Stanford kind of discussed with me would help in the initial charging of these individuals to get them off the streets, maybe put them behind bars for a while, and allow us time to process evidence so that we can prosecute these individuals more judiciously. Thank you.
Thank you, Lieutenant Schroeder. Detective Wright.
Thank you, Representative McPherson. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, if you look at Roman numeral number 2 on your program, I'm the subject to change. I literally was asked to speak here today about 5 minutes before I got here, so I don't have a prepared program. But I would like to say that I participated in the last cyber sting operation, and I guess this kind of fits under Oregon law enforcement efforts. The thing I wanted to say primarily is that in my 24 years of law enforcement experience, I was absolutely flabbergasted to see the stuff that was going on online today. Now, all of my children are grown and adults, so I'm not really, you know, into that chatting stuff and so on and so forth. I was just totally amazed, as I think we might have an example of that today later on. I know that there's a computer operating in the back of the room that's been operating since that we've been here, and there might be some numbers as to the amount of times that somebody has been solicited just since we've been here. I can't say it enough, I was just totally amazed of the people that would get online, and once they found out that I was a 13-year-old girl, that they didn't go away. they just didn't go away. They continued to talk with me, and right off the bat, as Xavier mentioned, and I think Detective Goldberg mentioned, right off the bat, it automatically goes right to sex. I was given several, I guess you could call them the little miniature camera things that people put on their computers, images of men that wanted me to watch them perform masturbation. And that's all they wanted. As of right now, if they didn't come to the house to be arrested, what are we going to do to them? It just blew me away. It really did. I've had a couple of cases that, maybe could have been handled a little bit differently had we had different laws. One of them involved a pretty high-profile case that, I think it was in 2004, a gentleman by the name of Douglas French enticed she was 15 at the time, maybe 16, a child from the Malala Library. She was missing for several months and finally located in Montana. He went to jail for a short amount of time. I believe it was in the area of 2 years or less. Got back out, and he got right back at it again. He posted a thing on Craigslist asking for girls in the ages of 16 to 19 so that he could photograph. He pretended that he was a professional photographer. He's looking for models. So he ended up within, I want to say, about 10 days of having sex with an underage girl that answered that ad. He was prosecuted, and he's in jail right now. And he had some issues, obviously, from his past. So he went away, and then we had another one here just very recently that's actually still in our system, where the actual relationship was enhanced or was furthered online through MySpace.com, just talking back and forth. You've heard many, many times here about Yahoo and all the Oregon chat rooms, so I'm not gonna go over that again, but it's all over. It's all over the internet. It doesn't really matter what the actual chat room is. It's everywhere. It's MySpace. It's Craigslist. And we need some teeth. I think you said teeth. That's a good word. We need some teeth. So thank you very much for allowing me to come here and ramble on for a few minutes. I hope we can get something done.
Thank you, Detective Bright. Are there questions for members of this panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you can answer. We're catching these adults that are truly predators. I'm guessing you probably have a lot of kids about the same age that are doing the same kind of hook it up.
Exactly. I've always said if there's not a market out there for this, then, what are we worried about? There's children out there that are doing this, and that's what these guys are looking for. They know that there's a market, so that's why they're doing it. And the cases that we get as law enforcement are the ones where the parents catch somebody. They find out something or one thing or another happens, and they call the police. We need to be out there proactively going after these guys so that we can catch the ones that are getting away with it right now, contacting those other children that are, for whatever reason, not being supervised or, they don't know parents don't know that they're doing it.
Thank you. Further questions, please? Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kevin Cameron from Salem, by the way. Just thank you for your coming here today to share with us. Question, you mentioned a situation where a graphic image or the guy sent these graphic images and asked the young lady to watch them. you have the technical, so we're talking about a law that will allow you to go and trace back to this guy and arrest him for that and have some pretty severe penalties to stop this from going further. You have the ability today to go back and identify that video, in fact, came from him, whether it is of him or not?
Maybe Andy could answer that question as far as how to trace back ISPs and so on. But right now, my understanding is, with talking with some of the federal guys that we were involved with in this sting operation, was that they have, federal side has some type of a crime, but my understanding is that it's such a minor thing that they don't want to waste their time with it, so to speak. If my understanding of the laws that are being proposed right now, just by them doing that, they're committing a C felony. So we have the capability of tracing those things back. The actual technical aspect of that, I know a little bit about it, but that could probably be better answered by Andy or even Josh. So
sure. We can, through subpoenas and other things, we can go back and figure out where the location of the computer was at the time. And through forensics, once we get a hold of that computer, whether we write a search warrant for it or get consent to look at it, a lot of times we can see exactly what hardware was connected, so maybe a webcam, and sometimes webcams will put images on the computer of what was shown. And it's been my experience that these individuals will normally show their face at some point. A lot of times they'll scroll up, or at least the background is identifiable of the place they're at. So once we get the computer and we look at inside of the house, we can usually make a positive identification. And of course, once we see the suspect, a lot of times if they do show their face, we can, or a tattoo or something like that, we can identify them.
Thank you. Mr. Carroll, how do Oregon's laws on internet predators compare with other jurisdictions, if you're aware of that?
Most of the ICACs that we deal with have online solicitation statutes that they deal with. I'm sorry, Chair McPherson and members. We are fairly weak in trying to take off the sexual solicitors, the online solicitors. A lot of the cases that we end up working on are child pornography cases. And to do a little bit of follow-up on Representative Cameron's question there, one of the problems that we've run into nationally is internet service provider retention of materials. There are different standards for different internet service providers, whether it may be 30 days or 6 months. NAG is working, and the National Association of Attorney Generals has worked with a number of internet service providers and asked for longer retention periods, maybe up to even a year. The internet service providers are saying to maintain that amount of data on their servers is going to be so voluminous that they can't conduct regular business. But we're very fortunate with the ICAC and with the Attorney General's office that we have administrative subpoena power so that we can kick out a subpoena as soon as we come across this. And a lot of times you may track an internet service provider. Let's say Comcast owns the block of IP addresses, and then they lease it to, say, CharterNet. So you have to do several different subpoenas to track these people back and locate who actually owns that account. Then you have to put the predator or the perpetrator behind the computer through old-fashioned police work interviews.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carroll. And for Sergeant Mullen, strikes me that this is a fair commitment of resources that your police department has made to this effort. What proportion of your time is spent on this, the internet predator issues?
Chair McPherson, this is 100% of my time is for high-tech crimes. I would say that I spend, I also have another detective from Medford that's full-time as well, so we do, I would say 50% of our casework is forensics and reactive type work, and then the other 50% is doing online crimes, and it would be, and that varies anywhere from exactly what we're talking about today to other online crimes such as identity theft and fraudulent use of credit cards and forgery. So we do a lot of other things as well, but it's split right down half between both types of investigations.
Okay. If there are no further questions, then I'll excuse this panel with thanks for coming out, gentlemen. We really appreciate that, and in particular to Sergeant Mullen for having come such a long way to bring us information from Southern Oregon. Our next panel will focus on prosecution of Internet predators. So I'd like to invite Greg Nyhus from the assistant, who's an assistant U.S. attorney, Mike Slousen from the Oregon Department of Justice, from the ICAC group, Mike Regan from Clackamas County DA's office, and Don Reese from the Multnomah County DA's office. Mr. Nyhus.
Thank you, Chairman McPherson. My name is Greg Nyhus. I'm an assistant United States attorney. I'm assigned to the violent crime section for the Oregon office of the United States Attorney's Office. And my principal area of prosecution is child exploitation crimes, although I do other Internet-related offenses that involve federal statute. I was asked to come here today to give you a brief overview and a snapshot of federal prosecution, how our office becomes involved, what principal statutes are used, and I want to talk a little bit about a national initiative called Project Safe Childhood, which is not unlike Project Safe Neighborhood, which deals with firearms. Our cases come to our office by virtue of probably four different principal areas. The first one, of course, is agency sharing through the ICAC. We work closely with our state and local partners, Bill Carroll and Michael Slauson, who you'll hear from today, to accept cases from the jurisdictions which have been referred to them by the ICAC. So a couple of cases do come to us that way. And secondly, the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, has a specified task force called Innocent Images. And the National Innocent Images Initiative is an undercover operation which targets online predators in the form of undercover agents pretending to be either children or parents of children that have what's been referred to as special needs, and those special needs generally referred to as sexual nature. Third, the Immigration Customs Enforcement, or ICE, their Operation Predator has resulted in a number of different arrests and referrals for prosecution to our office. Third-party referral, whether it's from a smaller police department, from other federal agencies such as the Department of Diplomatic Services, other districts, sometimes national takedowns occur where we coordinate local service of search warrants for cases which originate out of district. Foreign governments have referred us cases and other extraterritorial authorities which have jurisdiction over individuals which are doing business on behalf of the United States but don't necessarily commit the crimes within the United States. The statutes that the federal government uses to prosecute online predators, there are two, which each have two unique theories each, but overriding each one of those is the veil of interstate commerce. Each of all the conduct that the United States prosecutes through its statutes has to have a showing that some portion of the conduct either took place within a facility of interstate communication, there was some travel in interstate commerce, or there was some transportation in interstate commerce. By way of example, chatting on Yahoo, MSN, MySpace, or AOL, I guess is the very best example. In every single case of an AOL chat, the data from one chatter goes through Loudoun County, Virginia, which is what houses the AOL corporate headquarters, and then back out to the chatter. So if I was to be speaking with Mr. Reese here on my right, all of my data, regardless of how close we are together physically, would go through Loudoun County. And of course, once it hits the border between, well, it could be going to California or Washington, but once it hits a border, that's enough. A facility of interstate communication includes the phone, the mail, telegraph services, and of course, internet chat rooms. The two principal theories for targeting internet child predators, the first one is called, referred to generally as the travel statute. And it's identified or defined at Title 18 United States Code, Section 2423. Generally, this statute criminalizes the travel in interstate commerce to engage in an illicit relationship, which is, of course, defined as a sexual relationship. That includes people traveling to the child, encouraging the child to travel in interstate commerce, or asking someone to bring the child with them for that purpose. The age of consent, by virtue of statutory interpretation and definition, is 16 for that age. Most of you will remember Mr. Andrew Garver, who left the state with a young softball player several years ago, who was at that time 15 years old. She was from Beaverton. Mr. Garver was later discovered 9 months later in Tennessee. He was prosecuted under that statute. And by virtue of the fact she was under the age of 16, we were able to prosecute that federally. The second statute that the government uses most frequently is called enticement. Its true statutory title is called enticement and coercion. That is defined at 18 United States Code, Section 2422. Generally, 2422, or the enticement, has two general theories associated with it. First, it criminalizes the use of a facility of interstate communication to persuade, entice, coerce a minor to engage in prostitution or criminal sexual activity. The second theory is that it criminalizes inducing an individual to travel in interstate commerce for the purpose of engaging in prostitution or criminal sexual activity. The age of consent for the enticement statute is 18 years of age. For the first theory that I referred to, which is defined at 2422B, there is a 120-month mandatory minimum prison sentence for upon conviction. The third, and probably less germane here, but because a vast majority of the computers that are seized by the federal government or local agencies and referred to us contain child pornography, we also prosecute the child pornography cases where we can make a showing that the images have been manufactured using items which have traveled in interstate commerce, or the images themselves have traveled in interstate commerce. And there's many, many different ways to prove that. There are mandatory minimums that apply to the manufacture, distribution, and receipt, and upon a showing of a qualified conviction, to possession as well. Finally, in order to better coordinate the efforts of local law enforcement between state and locals and, of course, the federal government, local prosecutors' offices, and non-governmental organizations such as teachers' unions, PTAs, and other Catholic charities, the Attorney General in May of 2006 mandated the implementation of a Project Safe Childhood, which is not unlike the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. It requires each United States Attorney's Office to develop a plan by which to utilize the resources within its district most effectively to ensure several things. Most principal among them is to ensure that the resources that everyone has are maximized, to ensure the best prosecution at the most appropriate forum, federal or state. And finally, of course, to increase community education and awareness. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Nias. Next we'll hear from Mr. Slauson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Michael Slauson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice in the Criminal Justice Division, and I'm the prosecutor assigned to the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. Given that there is no specific statute in Oregon targeting Internet predators, those who would use the Internet to solicit children to engage in sexual acts or to commit sexually explicit conduct, I thought I'd spend my time talking about how that is currently prosecuted in Oregon and the potential impact of a new statute. As you've heard today from other presenters, it's currently that type of conduct is currently prosecuted in Oregon as an attempted crime. An attempted crime is one classification below a completed crime. So, for instance, if you've got a Class B felony as the completed crime, you'll have a Class C felony for the attempted crime. To prove attempt, the state must prove first that the person had the intent to engage in some sort of specific conduct. And so in the context of these types of cases, we look at the description of particular sex acts that the person's asking the child to engage in emails to see what crime would he be attempting to commit. If he describes certain acts that would fit within the crime of rape, then the charge would be attempted rape one. So that's the first prong, first thing we have to show to prove an attempted crime. The second thing we have to show, as you've also heard, is a substantial step toward commission of the actual offense, the actual rape or sex abuse. And in a lot of these cases, that's sort of where the rubber meets the road between having an attempted crime versus having a specific statute. Oregon courts have held that you can prove a substantial step toward the commission of a crime by words alone, but as a practical matter, to prove an attempted crime in these types of cases, you almost always have to have the suspect show up at the place, show up for the meeting. That's not technically a legal requirement, but just as a practical matter, trying to prove that before a jury or judge beyond a reasonable doubt requires that. The reason for it is because we often see the defense, you know, hey, I was just role-playing or I was just fantasizing. I had absolutely zero intent to ever meet up with any child. And so we usually find ourselves waiting until the meeting took place before we find a crime that we can charge. If a person is convicted with an attempted sex crime, then that person's sentence is determined by the crime seriousness of the underlying crime. I'm talking about, just briefly, kind of give the committee a spectrum of what we're talking about with attempted crime. So if you have your most serious crimes, like rape in the first degree, or sodomy in the first degree, or unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree, and you assume that the person has no criminal history under the Oregon sentencing guidelines, that person's looking at a sentence of 16 to 18 months in prison. However, in the particular grid that person would fall with no criminal history, if the judge found it appropriate, the judge could impose probation in that sentence. Now, if you're looking at based on the nature of what's described in the conversation they've had, whatever sex acts we're talking about, if we're actually looking at the sort of lesser offenses, maybe sex abuse 3, that would result in a maximum sentence of 6 months. So you're looking at sort of anywhere 6 months as the maximum sentence for the lower offenses, up to 16 to 18 months for the most serious offenses when you're talking about attempted crimes. The reality is, I think it's fair to say, that in most cases, without actually a completed sex act, most offenders are probably getting probation and fairly light jail sentences as a condition of the probation. That's sort of a brief thumbnail sketch of where we're at now with attempt law in Oregon, and I'd like to just take the remainder of my time briefly to talk about what a new solicitation bill might do. The first thing, we've talked about it a lot internally at our office, and kind of pulled out three things that we think probably the most significant. Of course, there's a lot of things it would do, but I just want to touch on the three most significant. It would eliminate the need to prove attempt to commit a specific sexual act. And you caught when I talked about attempt, you have to prove what specific crime the person intended to commit. Most of the proposed legislation I've seen refers generally to sexual conduct. And so what actually drives the end offense is the fact that the person solicited a child to engage in some type of sexual conduct, be it a rape or a sex abuse 3, but it's not dependent on what the actual solicitation was, just the fact that the solicitation was made. And that could be significant because it could lead to more proactive investigations as opposed to reactive investigations. Certainly, regardless of what the end crime is going to be, any law enforcement agency is going to follow up on a complaint from a citizen or from another law enforcement agency. But if you had a particular internet solicitation crime, you'd have some sort of uniformity of what the charge is. So you wouldn't have anywhere from 18 months, you know, down to probation. You'd actually have, if you had a Class C felony, you kind of know what you're getting into when you start the undercover operations. Second thing it does is pretty significant. It provides notice of exactly what's prohibited under Oregon law. Specific legislation relating to solicitation of children provides notice to the would-be offenders that you just simply cannot solicit children for sex, period. That's what it would be under Oregon law. In other words, you would no longer have that defense to say, hey, I was just fantasizing or role-playing. In other words, it's the solicitation itself that becomes a crime. It's not an attempt to commit some future crime. The third thing that it does that we thought significant is it makes the act of soliciting, as I just sort of mentioned, a completed crime without waiting until the predator shows up for the meeting. This gets to that substantial step requirement that I talked about earlier. In other words, you would allow the law enforcement to step in earlier in the process without the risk of not being able to prove that the predator took a substantial step toward commission of any one specific offense. So in real-world terms, what that means is when a parent comes to law enforcement with copies of emails from say they have a 15-year-old daughter and they're coming to law enforcement with emails from a 35-year-old man, and he's saying all the things he would like to do with the daughter, law enforcement's not going to be in a position then of having to try to prove an attempted crime either by proving that the guy set up a meeting in a hotel room or took some other steps toward actually having a meeting occur. And they're certainly not going to have to be in a position of telling the parent that there's really no crime that covers that conduct. Those are my comments. I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to talk about this important issue and be happy to answer any questions once the remainder of the panel is finished.
Thank you, Mr. Slauson. Mike Regan.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and fellow representatives. It's a pleasure to be here. I think I was invited here as someone who could maybe add some practical opinions on the cases that have most recently been conducted through these stings up in the Portland area with Kerry Tomlinson and Fox 12. And I don't want to repeat anything that Mike already said. Some of the ideas I had coming into this are some of the ones he's already shared, so I won't go into that. But what I'd like to admit firsthand is that I've been in our office for 22 years. I am the deputy in charge of these kind of cases, but in all honesty, there haven't been any of these kind of cases before. Kerry Tomlinson and the Clackamas County Sheriff, Craig Roberts, came together and decided to do something in our county. Like most of you probably, I've really learned about these through Datelines to Catch a Predator. I didn't like to admit that because there's a real salacious side to that show that I didn't like watching. But I found myself doing this kind of work, going home, watching that kind of show, and being compelled to continue to watch it. Which is why I think after 2 years it's still on the air, because it's amazing how interesting it is to watch. Now, I wondered as I watched it, well, what could we do in our county if this type of behavior occurred, which I assumed it was? And I thought about, well, we don't have a law like they seem to have in Texas and California and all these other places where Stone Phillips was wandering. But we started talking about it, and nothing ever really came to be. So it didn't matter until Channel 12, Fox News, approached Craig Roberts, our sheriff in Clackamas County, and there was a mutual understanding that from both points of view this would be a good thing. Now, meaning no disrespect whatsoever to Channel 12, because I think they provide amazing service, I wasn't really interested in getting into the salacious media part of it. It just wasn't the type of thing I do, and I'm used to as an attorney keeping publicity quiet. You know, we don't want to, as prosecutors, in any way create pretrial publicity for cases because we're worried that we commit some kind of ethical obligation by trying the case outside of court. But the sheriff met up with her, and I want to emphasize that he spent a tremendous amount of time and money in conducting months of preparation for a sting in order to capture six people.
having gone through it with them and only doing a tiny bit of it myself, really just being there for some legal advice, I can only assume that the media part of it by Ms. Tomlinson was a huge investment, and the sheriff's time was, you know, getting all the different detectives and patrol officers to get involved in manning the computers, to covering outside the house, to following the person from where he was coming to the house in case something else happened and he fled and they had to get him. People on the scene to be able to capture him when he got in there, all kinds of security concerns. And, you know, if you understand law enforcement, obviously all those are going to be separate components so that nobody gets tripping up on everybody else's. Now, I would like to reinforce what Mike said. The reason they had to do this is because our law is such that we didn't think that they would have committed an attempted sexual abuse unless they actually got to the door and knocked on it. At that point, convincing a judge that they had taken a substantial step toward engaging in sexual activity with a child. And what I like about the proposed legislation is that we don't have to do all that. We don't have to spend the time and the money that sheriff's departments and local PDs don't have to accomplish the goal. There's no question that just like the computer has changed property crime, and we had to adapt to it by enacting an identity theft law, because the old ways weren't the new ways that criminals were committing crimes. There's no question in my mind that sex crimes are changing too. And I don't think that everybody who's online is necessarily planning on meeting that 13-year-old to have sex. I do think there are people that are merely stopping at the fantasy. And I think that we would not accept in our own communities a local meeting place such as Pioneer Courthouse Square in downtown Portland, where predators could mix with 13-year-olds and have conversations of the type we'd listen to and not think that that was illegal. And that's what's happening on that box every night, is that all these folks are coming in and they're having this conversation, and that's all they may be doing, but that's planning on meeting that 13-year-old to have sex. I do think there are people that are merely stopping at the fantasy. And I think that we would not accept in our own communities a local meeting place such as Pioneer Courthouse Square in downtown Portland, where predators could mix with 13-year-olds and have conversations of the type we'd listen to and not think that that was illegal. And that's what's happening on that box every night, is that all these folks are coming in and they're having this conversation, and that's all they may be doing, but that's being exposed to all our kids. And I've come through the back door by watching these cases come through our office, and strongly support any efforts to make the simple act of talking about these things a crime, and a serious crime. That's pretty much what I came to say. I appreciate, you know, that we're doing that, that we may get there. It's certainly something we as prosecutors want to prosecute, because I think we see it every day. We know it's a real problem, and I'd compare it in closing almost to like the music downloading problem that they have nationally. And they know they can't prosecute every single downloader of music, but they've got to do something. And there has to be the perception out there with kids that it's illegal to make money or to deny money from the music companies, that it's a product that should be paid for. And I think if we accomplish nothing else, and I think more will be accomplished, it's extremely important that predators out there know that just the act of doing this is going to be investigated and prosecuted, and simply having the legitimacy of a new crime on the books that says that would do a large part to head off some of this. So thank you very much for inviting me. I'll wait for questions as well.
Thank you, Mr. Regan. Mr. Reese.
Thank you, Chairman McPherson, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Don Reese. I'm a deputy district attorney from Multnomah County, and I supervise the unit that prosecutes sex crimes where the offender is not related to the victim, and that would include child victims. And unfortunately, when I see cases involving internet predators come into my office, the damage has already been done. That is, the predator has already met the victim online, has already enticed them into sexual activity, has met them, and has engaged in some type of child sexual assault against the victim. Most recently, a man in his 20s named Michael Loza began an online communication with an 11-year-old boy in Gresham, a lonely boy who was online looking for friends. He thought Michael Loza was a teenage boy, maybe 16 or 17 years old, and they talked about their mutual interest in music, movies, what was going on in their lives, and this little 11-year-old boy thought he had found a new friend. And as time went on, the conversation turned to sex talk and finally to explicit two-way conversations about various sexual acts. And when this boy in Gresham turned 13, Michael Loza proposed that he would fly out to Oregon and meet the boy, and he did, and he got a room in a motel in Gresham, and every day after school for a week, this middle school child rode his bicycle home, or not home, from school, not to home, to the motel where he was sexually abused by this man, Michael Loza. And all of this went on without any knowledge of any parent or teacher, because Michael Loza had the opportunity and the ability to communicate with this boy without any adult scrutiny. In that respect, the internet, as you've been hearing all afternoon, is really a paradise for a pedophile, because if an adult were to reach out to an 11-year-old child and start this kind of conversation, whether it was in a Boy Scout troop or in an athletic situation with a coach and a player, although these things do happen, at least there are adults around. At least there is the ability for parents to watch and to be concerned. But in this case, no one knew about these communications. And it was only after the fact and after the damage was done that a Gresham police officer named Jim Seymour happened to see Michael Loza in the parking lot outside of this motel and was suspicious about the various circumstances. And upon questioning Michael Loza and finding some correspondence from this boy, went back to the boy's house and made the case. And it was actually with the assistance of Greg Nias in the U.S. Attorney's Office and my office working together with the federal prosecutors. Michael Loza was sent to prison for 100 months. So in that case, there was a good result in that this person was stopped and they were punished. But again, the unfortunate aspect of that case is that it highlights that as a local prosecutor in Oregon, I'm only seeing this kind of case after the fact. Had a parent or teacher or friend come to the Gresham Police Department before Michael Loza came out from New Jersey and said, "What's this sex talk? What's going on? Who is this person and why are they communicating with this 11 or 12-year-old boy?" As you've been hearing this afternoon, the answer probably would be that nothing could be done because no substantial step towards a crime had occurred. And so not only would we be unable to charge a completed sex act, because of course that hadn't occurred, but not even an attempt of that sex act. And so there would be no consequence, and assumedly the pedophile, once stopped, would simply move on to the next victim. Thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Reese. Any questions from Representative Krieger?
Mr. Chair, this isn't something that's being prosecuted as much because we don't have the right laws in Oregon. Do you have any idea how many prosecutions you might be having to deal with and how that might affect the correction system and probation?
I assume this question is directed to me. Well, Representative Krieger, that's difficult to say. I don't know because, again, we're seeing the cases submitted by law enforcement agencies when there has been at least a completed act or, at the very least, a step towards that completed act. But I would say in terms of numbers, when there have been conversations about this proposed law or even cases like the Michael Loza case, you know, where we have federal assistance because there are federal laws in place, there simply are not enough assistant United States attorneys and federal courtrooms to handle even the cases that we have now. And maybe Mr. Nias can explain more about that, but they're simply currently, you know, as a local prosecutor, I can't rely on the federal government to handle all of these cases.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reese, in the example that you just gave, the perpetrator was from New Jersey, so that allowed you to have the facilitation with the U.S. Attorney's Office because it involved interstate traffic. Is that right?
Right. The connection for the federal government was that Mr. Loza flew across interstate lines to come to Oregon. They also had an additional interest in the case because Mr. Loza brought with him a collection of child pornography when he met this boy.
Thank you. So that meets all the elements of the Title 18 USC requirements that Mr. Nias laid out for us. Is that correct?
That's my understanding. And the way the case was divided then is that my office prosecuted Mr. Loza for the sex acts that occurred with the boy, and Mr. Nias prosecuted him for the travel and the possession of child pornography. But again, you know, I cited that case because I think it's compelling given the age of the child and the nature of the offense, but it's also the exception where we were able to work together and do that. I really think you know, we need to be in a position where we would have been able to stop Mr. Loza just at the point where he's grooming this child and having those sexual communications with him.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
You may.
Thank you. Then, Mr. Slauson, the crimes that we see in Oregon, they don't have an interstate element. Is that what I would glean from this discussion?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, it's not required under Oregon law like it is under the federal law because of the Commerce Clause to have an interstate connection. Some of our investigations certainly do lead us outside the state, just as an example we just had, just because of the Internet.
Thank you.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had two questions. Unfortunately, one of them has been answered, so I only have one left, and that is the type of solicitation statute that you're mentioning where you would not need to have the meeting to prove the substantial step. Do other states already have that type of solicitation law, especially states near us?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, that's true, yes. Many other states do have that type of legislation, and then they vary to some degree as to whether the communication itself has to be over the Internet or it can be some other form of electronic communications. But there are a number of states, I don't know the exact number, that do have that type of legislation.
Make it a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Do any of you have any suggestions about what you think is working best in one of the states that has that type of solicitation statute?
Representative Bonamici, if I could mention one aspect of the laws that I've seen that I think is important to consider, and this just came up before the Nevada legislature, is to include as part of a criminal act communication with a law enforcement agent so that there's no defense available where someone could say, well, I actually wasn't enticing a child, it was a police detective.
Yeah, I know I'm going to get this question from some folks, probably from family. So how do you go about dealing with the entrapment discussion?
That addressed me now.
Anyone here can answer, please.
Chairman McPherson and Representative Flores, our agents, and I think the ICAC also does this too, are trained, well, specifically to avoid that. I know that the FBI Innocent Images Undercover Task Force members, the Operation Predator Task Force members, and other agents that we work with on the when the federal government receives cases directly are trained to avoid entrapment. And in explaining the difference between entrapping an individual to commit the crime and offering an opportunity to commit the crime, there is a distinct difference in the nature of the chat, in the tone of the chat, taken as a whole and in part separately, that demonstrate that the agent or the officer is merely opening the store for business rather than pushing the person inside to make a purchase.
I have a question that I'll throw out to the panel and let anyone who wants to weigh in comment. What I'm understanding is that under Oregon's current law, it's necessary for the perpetrator to be out at the doorstep, in effect, trying to make a connection. If we change our law so that it becomes possible to prosecute someone at the point where they've solicited over the Internet, then what difficulties of prosecution do you anticipate? That is, how effectively will you be able to prosecute under such a statute, given issues about chain of custody of evidence, about making sure it was that individual who was actually at the keyboard, those kinds of evidentiary problems? And I'll just let anybody comment who has perspective.
Chair McPherson, I assume there's still going to be that problem because you're still going to have to prove identity, so there's going to have to be some kind of meet-up planned in order to find the guy and make sure it's the same guy. But going back to your earlier point, that it's not necessary that our Oregon law requires that the person show up at the door. By way of some background, what we're used to as prosecutors is people versus people crimes. And when you prove, in order to prove an attempted rape, for instance, it's generally true when it's person to person, not over the Internet, that you have to prove someone almost did it in order for it to be a substantial step towards it. Now, in common parlance, people face to face don't say what they say on the Internet. What we've learned through our Clackamas County cases is through these chat logs, the specificity of the substance is so unreal. These guys are actually proving the case against them. I want to come over to your house and blank, 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 blank. And we don't usually in person-to-person crimes have that kind of specificity because we do with chat logs that you can save and introduce as exhibits. It's easier to prove a substantial step, actually. But we've decided, on our cases at least, that we needed some point, to get back to Mike's point, where there wasn't a renunciation of the crime. If the guy was going to drive by and not show up, that isn't a substantial step. He thought about it. Maybe the fantasy was enough and drove off and never actually went to do it. What we'd like to see is a situation where we don't have to actually prove the meeting, but prove that the sexual exploitation on that computer is in and of itself enough. Now, of course, I think as attorneys, we would still not be charging cases that weren't severe, bad, explicit language.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Well, if there are no further questions, then I'll excuse this panel. And gentlemen, thank you very much for coming today and for your work in improving the public safety of Oregonians.
Thank you.
Our next panel, we would have had a request for a 5-minute break, so but let's do hold it to 5 minutes and then we'll reconvene. We have our next panel who will give us some insights into the mind of the predator. We have two members of this panel, Steve Jensen from the Center for Behavioral Intervention in Beaverton and Barry Maletsky, the Sexual Abuse Clinic. Mr. Jensen.
Chairman McPherson and members of the committee, I am Steve Jensen. I'm the director of the Center for Behavioral Intervention. We have been treating sex offenders and evaluating sex offenders for about 20 years. I've been in the business for a little over 34 years. I'm going to talk a little bit about the personality and motivation of the internet predator, because I think people don't understand them, plain and simple. First of all, internet predators are really quite different than the average sex offender. They're different in that they're much more aggressive, and they're much more predatory. The run-of-the-mill child molester is certainly dangerous, but it isn't at all similar to this kind of predator. These people have a very clear sexual preference. They're not opportunistic like most offenders are. They use very sophisticated strategies, obviously webcams, the internet, other things. They're not simply situational or impulsive like most offenders. They have sophisticated planning that goes on, many times months and close to years in some cases, where most offenders are rather impulsive and are very slow in their progressive acts. They also often believe that there's nothing really wrong with sexual activities with children. And this is very different than many sex offenders. Most sex offenders know it's wrong, but they are impulsive and compulsive and don't control themselves. They also have much better self-regulation. They appear quite normal, as people have presented before. They can be teachers, they can be attorneys, they can be any member of the community and appear very normal to those around them. While the traditional sex offender is less regulated, let's just put it that way, and often have numerous problems. After the act of sexual aggression, these people do not feel guilt like normal sex offenders do. Normal sex offenders don't feel tremendous guilt, but they feel a sense of doing something wrong. And they know clearly they've done something against the law, while these people really don't. And what these people do from committing crimes is they refine their techniques. They get better and better and better because they make better and better plans each time. Well, the average sex offender seldom refines his techniques. A word or two about treatment. These people have little or no motivation for treatment. They are very satisfied with their life. They are very satisfied with the way they conduct themselves. Their core beliefs involve sex with children is not hurtful and is not wrong. They're unlikely to accept traditional treatment. They don't do well in traditional treatment. They drop out. And sentencing today, with sex offenders in general, lacks motivation to begin or complete treatment. And just lastly, I think we need to remember, everyone wants these people locked up, of course. And I'm not objecting to that at all. But everyone gets released sooner or later. And when they're released, the treatment community needs to be able to do something with them. We can't do something with them when there aren't sufficient laws to hold them on probation, parole, or to some legal sanction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Dr. Maletsky.
Chairman McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Barry Maletsky. I'm a retired psychiatrist. Up until 2003, I was director of the Sexual Abuse Clinic, a clinic that began in 1978 to treat sexual offenders and has treated thousands of offenders over the years. However, it's only been recently that we have begun treating internet predators. I'll try to give perhaps a somewhat different and certainly not more informed or intelligent, but perhaps a bit more nuanced view of how we see these problems and present some of the scientific literature in the field. I would say that in preparation for this testimony, I was disappointed by the lack of studies particularly relating to internet abuse, even though it has first been noted in the literature in the 1990s, early to mid-1990s, very few scientific studies have been carried out about internet predators. I'll tell you two cases very quickly. neighbor of a boy asked him to do some chores. He's an upstanding man in the community, participated in a number of voluntary board organizations, and wasn't anything to mark him as somewhat different or interested in young boys. But as he got to know this boy, he began to show him some pornography on the internet, tried to get him sexually aroused, and tried to engage him in sexual activity. He wound up taking sexual photographs of the boy in return for gifts. He would pretend to be paying him for chores around the house, but would actually be rewarding him for allowing the man to photograph him in various sexual positions. We then learned that the man actually put those pictures on the internet and sold them on the internet. Second case is a man who lived in the same house as his niece, 7 or 8 year old girl. He used emails to begin an interaction with her on the internet, even though he lived in the same house. And as she grew to be 11, 12, or 13, the interactions became more and more sexual in nature and wound up being frankly sexual. He arranged meetings with her through the internet. He communicated sexually with her. And this case underlined to several things. One is that although the common perception of use of the internet is by strangers and predators, in fact, almost half of internet sexual predation is by someone that the victim knows. The other thing that reminded us of is the three A's that are very commonly talked about in the literature on internet sexual abuse. Accessibility. The internet is always on, and it's easy to use. Affordability and anonymity. Now, the anonymity part we can work on technically, but the internet remains very accessible and affordable, and it's much easier for predators to go online than to show up in person with a car that bears their license plate at a public swimming pool or hang around a school. So the internet has provided a tool for many predators. They groom victims on the internet. They store and disseminate images, arrange meetings. They view pornography and advertise pornography on the internet. Some studies put things into perspective for us, however. The National Juvenile Online Victimization Study, carried out in the early years of the 21st century, characterized predators as 39% had an identified victim. That included production of pornography. 25% were caught in stings. They were sham solicitations. And 36% were simply viewing internet child pornography. They were possessing it, but also distributing it. Of these men, 83% pled guilty, and that's quite a difference between actual child molesters or rapists and internet predators. We heard earlier today about conviction rate, and in our experience, both the pleading guilty and conviction rates have been much higher because there's hard evidence. We're not relying on a child's testimony, a child's memory, or even an adult's statement of victimization of a child. So it's easier to prosecute the cases when they can be discovered. Youth Internet Safety Survey was interesting. Finkelhor of New Hampshire carried this out, again, 2003, I believe. 25% to 33% of kids experience what they called unwelcome exposures to sexual material online. Now, most of these kids said, I mistyped a URL, or I put in too broad a search term, and that's how I got sexual images, or I got someone in a chat room who solicited me. We don't know if the kids are always telling the truth. Some kids, frankly, are looking for excitement, and we've seen some victims that we've talked to who admitted going online purposefully to meet adults. But there are confusing web addresses and exit loops that are difficult to get out of. Once you get on a pornography site, if you try to exit, you bring up more pornography. Unfortunately, we have no study of the effects on kids of viewing sexual material online, and no study as yet of the effects on kids of being solicited online. And that's to our discredit. There are a number of studies carried out on sexual offenders and effectiveness of treatment, but we have very few studies on the effects on kids and teenagers of viewing any of this material or being solicited. There are several recent surveys. Women, it was interesting to note that women surf the net looking for romance, sexual sites, and meetings as frequently as men do. Most men viewing child pornography online and engaging in sexual chat online do not go on to molest kids, but a certain percentage do. And among that percentage, we don't know exactly what that, perhaps 4 to 10% in some surveys, will go on to actually solicit and try to meet a kid. But we can't distinguish who those men might be right now. In a large study of thousands of kids, Finkelhor found that 80% of kids had never received a sexual solicitation, so 20% had. 2% reported what they called aggressive sexual solicitation. I don't know what that means. 25% of kids had seen pornography on the Internet. 5% felt they had been harassed. It was also interesting, a recent study estimated 40 million people visited a sex site in 2006 in this country. Last study I'll mention is Raymond Coleman and Cooper. Of those viewing pornography, and this is all pornography, it was also interesting, a recent study estimated 40 million people visited a sex site in 2006 in this country. Last study I'll mention is Raymond Coleman and Cooper. Of those viewing pornography, and this is all pornography, about 1% were compulsive viewers. And this poses a problem for us in treatment because some men will spend hours and hours online viewing pornography, some of it child pornography, and they're directed into those sites. As I said before, it's hard to escape them sometimes. Only about 0.3% tried to entice kids into sexual activity, but it's that 0.3% we're most concerned about. Many of those men are predatory. The third area I wanted to cover is what can we as treatment providers do? Well, we have to distinguish between an online predator and a man with no history of abusing kids who is fishing for a connection with a teenager. The treatment approaches would differ. Both need treatment. And treatment, by the way, has been very effective for many child molesters and predators, but not all. It's important also to remember that no treatment or legislation will eliminate paraphilias. So we're trying to do the best we can. What we need when we identify an offender online is a prior history. And police reports, pre-sentence investigations, child agency reports are very helpful because offenders most often don't tell the truth. It was also interesting to read the literature in that patients arrested in a sting and sent to treatment are harder to treat initially. In our experience, they're more litigious and more resentful. But they're not impossible to treat. One of the problems that Steve Jensen mentioned is supervision. We find that the online predators who are arrested, plead guilty, or are found guilty, are not supervised as closely as the men who actually molest kids or rape. And with the short sentences they're given and the short periods of time that they're under supervision in the community, we don't have often enough time to treat them. In addition, supervision of the internet offender in the community, the supervisors need to eliminate or monitor online use. Putting in a block, not a technical expert, but putting in an automatic block, I'm told, often does not work. And so the parole officers really need to consider these guys more dangerous and follow them more closely. As we'll hear in the next panel, there's a lot that we can do as families to prevent cyber abuse. There's a cyber tip line that everybody knows about. I have the 800 number if anyone wants it. You can go online with your kids. Going online with the kids, I think, can be a significant step. Keeping IDs private, limiting computer time and chat room access, no response to stranger emails, talking with kids about sex. All of these, I think, we'll hear more in more detail about later. I did want to close by mentioning what may be a contrarian point of view, but one that I think the Judiciary Committee should consider, and that's the benefits of the Internet. In the 16th century, priests tried to ban books, afraid of the effect, adverse effect they would have on the population. The Internet has been a very helpful tool for people in sexuality. We treated a young teen who was very lonely. He was gay, and he found online that other people felt the way he did. He joined an online chat group and received a great deal of support in recognizing his own identity. The same can be said for the many gender-disordered individuals that we've treated. Gender identity disorder is a very real biologic disorder, and many of these people can find solid support and real help for their problems online. Groups for minorities online are very important to maintain intact, I believe, and should not be touched by any legislation. Sexual education, prevention of STDs, the demystification of sex, reducing its stigma and embarrassment can be very important, and we would hate to see legislation which creates problems in prosecution because it's overly broad. The Internet has opened up opportunities for women in repressive countries and corrects a lot of misinformation about sex. So I think it is an important vehicle in that regard. As treatment providers, we can help perhaps to a limited extent in drafting legislation, but I think we can help most by conducting more research. And I think that what we need to do is look at the impact that online predation has on kids and teenagers. I think we must be careful in crafting wise legislation which helps prevent online predation while preserving the benefits that the Internet can provide. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Maletsky. Are there any questions for Representative Krieger?
Mr. Chair, you mentioned 0.3% were apt to want to contact juveniles. Kind of wonder what the total number would be that you could get the 0.3%. Another thing was that of that group, is the motivation for the most part to actually include the sexual act and the physical satisfaction from the act?
Chairman Pearson, Representative Krieger, I believe that it is. That group, 0.3%, comes from a larger group of all men visiting Internet sexual sites.
Okay.
It's still a small number, but a very dangerous group of men. We have not found women predators on the web, even though we have treated women offenders, by the way. The men who actually go online to entice, mostly it's young teen girls to medium teen girls, 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old girls, are going online with the hope of meeting them for a sexual encounter. In my experience, we don't have hard data. I'm sure there are some men who go online simply to fulfill a fantasy for the moment and do not plan to meet up with anyone. But in my opinion, the majority of men taking that step would go on to actually meet a teen if presented with that opportunity.
Go ahead. From what I've heard today, this is, you know, we have only so much capacity within the judicial system, the correction system. You know, if we can find a way to identify these people better, maybe perhaps that's where emphasis needs to be and what we want to do in Oregon. Because, like you say, it's the physical act that they're there to perpetrate on these young women for the most part.
Senator Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jensen, you described internet predator versus the sexual predator and went through the different characteristics. Is there not any overlap? Could one be the other and vice versa? And a follow-up to that, do you or your colleague there have any statistics that more predators are involved in jobs working with children?
Chairman McPherson, Representative Quisnet. The first answer to your question is certainly there's crossover between those. The emphasis I wanted to make here is that the people that we've been talking about that solicit teenagers on the internet are much more aggressive, much more predatory than your average sex. They're more like a rapist that goes out and seeks someone to rape, hangs out in the car parking lot or something like that, waiting for a woman to come to her car. So they usually progress. They don't all start that way. Internet perpetrators have determined that they're interested in a certain age group and a certain sex. That doesn't happen over the internet. That happens usually from fantasies, possibly contact, probably lots of masturbation. But that's already set by the time we're seeing these people select victims over the internet. Now, the second part of your question, could you repeat that?
Is there any studies about that more of these people have careers or are involved in working with children?
It's our experience that the vast majority of career pedophiles do work with children. We have lots of teachers, lots of camp counselors, lots of coaches, lots of ministers. It makes sense. If you're interested in molesting children, then put yourself in a position to have lots of access to children. And that's exactly what they do. They're Sunday school teachers. They're in the churches. Now, do they have more access? We happen to see these people come from these groups. We don't really know that there are more of them in these groups, but they get identified more readily. We only identify a handful of sex offenders compared to the number of sex offenders that perpetrate, and we only convict a handful of them also. So we're talking about a small percentage of those people who are acting out in a deviant sexual way, but we do know that many of them come from these occupations that give them access to children.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if both of you could talk perhaps about what might allow you to predict some success in treatment, and in particular, Mr. Jensen, I think you talked about early on the need for more incentives for people to be involved in treatment.
Chairman McPherson and Mr. Representative Reed, I'm trying to do this right.
No problem.
The biggest problem we have today is when a court orders sex offender treatment or the parole board orders sex offender treatment, it means nothing. It is not followed up on. There's no rules that say this person will participate in treatment or will complete treatment, because once parole or probation is over, he doesn't have to do any of those things. So one of the real problems, and with Measure 11 has been part of this, is people have very short parole periods, very short probation periods. They don't have time enough to complete treatment. They certainly don't have the incentive on their own to complete treatment. The kind of people we're talking about here take years in treatment and years of follow-up. It isn't adequate to have 3 years or 4 years. When you have a lifetime activity of involving yourself with children, and most of these people start as teenagers and progress on through, you know, 30, 40, 50 years old. When you've been doing something that long that's been highly rewarding, you don't stop in a matter of years, and you don't overcome this problem in a matter of years. Treatment is something you really do to yourself, but you need others to assist you, and outside incentives can be very helpful, like probation officers or supervision or polygraphs or things of that nature. We need a long period of time to do a decent job rather than have these people drop out halfway through treatment.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jensen, in your dealing at your behavioral intervention clinic,
yes.
Have you encountered offenders who have expressed that they were exploring their sexuality, as the example given by Dr. Molesky, rather than they were actually perpetrating crimes on young victims?
Chairman McPherson and Representative Flores, sex offenders come up with every excuse known to man. I accidentally stumbled and fell into this little girl's vagina. People tell us this. I was by her bedside, and I was there for 10 minutes, but I was just being sure she was asleep. We hear every silly excuse known to man. And yes, Dr. Molesky's example was typical. I was just kind of role-playing on the Internet. I never would do this. I would never think of this kind of thing. The fact that I have four other convictions for the same behavior doesn't seem to interfere with that. So, yes, sex offenders, the first thing you do with sex offenders is get them to admit culpability and then take responsibility. That can take years in some cases because they do not want to take responsibility. And as a society, we tell them, oh, it was because you were molested. Oh, it was because you were drinking alcohol. It was because you were on drugs. It was because your wife wasn't kind to you. We don't seem to understand that when you molest a child, it's a purposeful act and you do it purposefully. You know, it doesn't happen because of any of these other things. It can't happen. You have to make a decision to act in this way. But the answer is they have a million excuses.
Committee, maybe just one more question, but we do have one more panel we need to hear from.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, Mr. Jensen, you mentioned Measure 11 as part of the problem. Or can you clarify what you said by that? I didn't follow your...
Yes, Chairman McPherson and Representative
Cameron.
You really opened a can of worms here. Measure 11 has taken a number of people, placed them in incarceration for long periods of time, which has resulted in them being very hardened criminals, and then it has released them with a very limited amount of time, usually 10 years probation minus time served. Or 10 years parole minus time served is typical. So we're seeing 3 years plus on parole or on parole. That is not sufficient time to do treatment. There's also good data that suggests that people who are incarcerated for more than 3 years go downhill. It does not prevent reoffense, and in fact, if anything, it creates more offenses for many offenders. Now, there is many offenders that need to be in prison for 75 months and many more months, I might add. And there's no question we have many predatory, aggressive offenders that should be locked up. But frankly, today prosecutors have found ways around Measure 11 by simply not charging. They won't charge sexual abuse 1, they charge sex abuse 2. But the answer to this is more supervision on the outside and maybe lesser time on the inside, from my perspective.
Thank you. Thank you very much, panelists. Let's move on to our last panelist. And thank you again, Mr. Jensen and Dr. Molesky. It was very informative. Let's move to panel number 5, our last panel of the day, focusing on the education of children and parents about cyberspace safety. We have Micah Pearson from the Oregon Department of Justice, Ben Hicks from the Department of Justice, George Houston from Cyber Awareness, Responsibility, and Ethics, and Esther Cookson, Director of Strategic Planning for WebWiseKids.org. Mr. Pearson.
Yes, sir. Chairman McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Micah Persons. I'm a police officer with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm currently assigned as a criminal investigator to the Oregon Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. My supervisor, Bill Carroll, spoke earlier about what the task force is responsible for, and I think throughout this afternoon you've already been able to tell the enormity of the problem that these issues bring. So it's not a far stretch to understand that education needs to be a very basic piece of this fight against child exploitation. And one thing I want to mention is when we talk about online predators, the bigger global picture is child exploitation as a whole. And when we're talking about online predators, we're talking about people who are trying to entice our children and meet them online. But we're also talking about people, once the investigation is complete and you go and interview these people, not only are they online predators, but they're also child pornographers and they're also child abusers. So it seems like the focus of the discussion today has been primarily around people enticing children from the age of 11, 12, 13, 14 years old. But what we need to understand is these same type individuals are engaged in distributing and producing pornography that identifies and shows kids 3-4 years old having full-on insertion sex with adult males. So we're not talking about just talking dirty on the computer and trying to meet up with somebody in their early teens for the purpose of a sexual relationship. We're talking about people who are engaging in activities, they're collecting images of kids that are being sexually abused. So I think we need to look at it as a larger picture. And I think what you'll see both nationally and on the local level as this presentation has been today, there's kind of a three-prong approach. And we've talked about prosecution, and we've talked about investigation, and the other prong of that is absolutely education. And fortunately, with the Oregon Department of Justice, we have the opportunity to go into the schools and go into different community forums and talk to fellow law enforcement officers about the problems that are going on out there. And even with that, we have presented to thousands of people throughout Oregon, all of Southern Oregon, Eastern Oregon, all over, and over hundreds of presentations. And every time we go and we present, there is always someone who comes up and says, A, I was a victim of this exact thing. I didn't know that anybody knew about it. Or B, there my cousin of mine or my child has engaged in this type of activity, and thank God you're out here letting us know that this problem exists. And these are small communities. We're not talking about the metro area. We're talking about very small communities where, you know, there are situations where we'll be out where we can't even get cell service, but they still have high-speed internet service. So they still have the ability to go online and chat with the potential predators. And one thing with the education that we see is there's kind of three focus areas that are stumbling blocks for law enforcement who are going out and training in internet safety. And, you know, the three of them are, we identify, you know, parents, teachers, counselors as one group, and then we have children and we have law enforcement. With parents, what we're seeing is there's a huge gap in the amount of technological knowledge between parents and their children. So here you have their child who's very advanced and their parents who are not, and we're wanting to promote that the parents need to go out there and be proactive in their education of computers and the internet as well, because if you're a soccer coach and you're a baseball coach and you've never coached a sport, by all means you're going to go to a coach's clinic early in the season so you can identify what do I need to teach these kids. And I think your child's safety is one of the most basic things that we can do as parents and as law enforcement. And so getting parents to understand that is a huge part of our education. When you're dealing with the kids, everybody has done a fantastic job about saying, say no to drugs, stranger danger, don't take candy from strangers, don't help that stranger look for his dog when he comes up and asks you for him, don't do those things. And it's become so commonplace that kids know this, and any kid can recite it, except they don't know that those same type dangers lurk on the internet. So you have a child who goes onto the internet, is engaged in different online gaming and different chats, and they can have all sorts of different personas, and they're thinking, well, what I do online is not going to affect me in real life. And oftentimes they're doing it from the comfort of their own home. So what safer environment is there than your own home? Well, that's part of what we need to let them know, is that the kids that are out there online, that what they're doing online is going to affect them in their everyday lives, and the predators can affect them as well. With law enforcement, and as a police officer, you get so inundated with cases that you have to investigate and the rules that you have to follow that oftentimes when there's new technology that comes up and there's new laws that we must apply, they have to be very applicable and specific to the job that we're doing. Because if you can't show how applicable a tool is, because there are so many investigators in law enforcement that are so overworked and their resources are so low, that if you don't let them know this is how this can help you, this is how it can make your job easier, oftentimes it's not going to happen. Because when you're hustling to get the things done, just to do the basics on a large number of cases, you want to know what can I do that's going to make my job the easiest, that's going to have the most effect. And so that's kind of what we see with education. So you'll hear from my partner, Ben Hicks, and it's just, there's no excuse why we're not, everyone's not out in the community and promoting this. We're at the very beginning of how bad this epidemic is going to get, and we can arrest people all day and charge them with these laws that we're hoping they're going to come out, but unless we get out and educate, we're not going to cut anybody off of the pass, and all we're going to be doing is reactive investigations to crimes that maybe we could have prevented. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Pearson. Mr. Hicks.
My name is Ben Hicks. Good afternoon. One of the things that I'm a police officer, and I'm assigned to the Oregon Department of Justice with the Internet Crimes Against Children. And we do investigations and we do a lot of education. And one of the things that we talk to when we go to talk to kids is about personal information. What is personal information? If you ask them, they'll tell you that it's a checkbook number or a credit card number. We ask them how important a school name is. They'll tell us, oh, it's not so important. When we went to Lake Oswego and we gave one of our talks prior to going to the middle school, we found out there were 925 students in this middle school. Prior to going, we went to MySpace, just one of the social networks of 1,000 of those networks, but the most popular that you read about. We ran a query just on the name of the school. 450 middle school students, many of them under the age of 14, are using that, and they're putting that their school, that's where they attend. That's 450 students that are at risk by a predator that know exactly where they go to school. So when we talk to them about personal information, we talk to them about talking with their parents or talking with schoolmates about what can I put on my MySpace. You know, we're not saying that MySpace is bad. It's about what you put on it. We ask the kids where the computer that they use most is located in their home. Guess what? It's in their bedroom. 80% of them are in their bedroom. That's the place they feel the safest, where nothing can happen to them. That's when they get on and they play their games and they want to find out. You know, they read about predators, and oftentimes they go out looking for predators. You know, it's not what you'd think they would be doing. I have friends that's exactly what their 14-year-old daughters went out to find out. How prevalent were they? They found out really close hand how easy it was to find a predator. We talk to parents about getting involved with your kids. There's no question the kids are going to know more about the computers than you do and about the sites. Sit down with your kids and talk to them. Teach me about chatting. Take one night and teach me how to chat. I want to learn how. It shows involvement with the children. The other thing we talk about with the parents is parental controls. We tell them, you know, there's great software out there to monitor what your kids are doing, great software to lock your kids out of certain areas. You can turn your routers off at a certain time. What we tell them is the controls are great, but if you lock your kids out of your home, they're going to go next door where you can't maintain control of them. So overall, we hear today about we all know what predators are, and we have a pretty good idea what we need to do on the law enforcement side and on the legal side. What we need to do in the education is we need to get Dateline to talk about what can parents do to keep their children safe. That's what we need. We need to educate the parents and the kids. You know, the one thing that we give a lot of talks to the kids in schools, we don't know how many we're saving. We show a video to them. It's called Tracking Teresa. We're going to show it today to you. But it's about 4 minutes, and it takes a little bit of time. It shows the kids in a very short order how easy it is to find them with almost no information. The video was made 4 or 5 years ago. The tools are much better today, and the predators know these tools. They know how to track using the buddy system with the instant messaging. They know all of this. We need to educate the public much, much better.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hicks. Mr. Houston.
Representative McPherson, members of the committee, my name is George Houston. I'm a retired FBI agent, currently working for the Hillsborough Police Department. And I spent the balance of my career, majority of my career with the FBI, working cyber crimes and crimes against children cases. I probably represent the more formative years of the Bureau being involved in that. I was doing these cases before they had innocent images and whole squads of agents working these cases. So it's good to see that there has been progress, at least in terms of putting resources from the federal side into this. We live today within the initial, what I would call the Big Bang of the cyber universe. Verily, before there was cyberspace, there existed parents. People of my generation and older who had never touched a computer growing up, let alone fathom the possibility that many computers could network and create this global organic thing called the Internet. The youngsters amongst us today who have been born into the information age are, righteously in many ways, frustrated with those who have not been born into the Big Bang, but who either struggle daily to assimilate within it or who reject and turn away from it. So what we face out of the gate is that within the cyber Big Bang, we are experiencing acceleration of generational divisions. Our cultural DNA is being stretched. Lost among these peaks and troughs of the virtual shockwaves emanating from this Big Bang are the kids. My generation and older, who had never touched a computer growing up, let alone fathom the possibility that many computers could network and create this global organic thing called the Internet. The youngsters amongst us today who have been born into the information age are, righteously in many ways, frustrated with those who have not been born into the Big Bang, but who either struggle daily to assimilate within it or who reject and turn away from it. So what we face out of the gate is that within the cyber Big Bang, we are experiencing acceleration of generational divisions. Our cultural DNA is being stretched. Lost among these peaks and troughs of the virtual shockwaves emanating from this Big Bang are the kids. The irony is that though kids are most adapted to the virtual world, they are among the most vulnerable to the threats from that world. Kids must be educated and equipped to meet these cyber threats. Hillsborough built a curriculum called CARE, Cyber Awareness, Responsibility, and Ethics, and that can be found at www.cybercareoregon.org. The stress of this program is on the E for ethics, and we define that as to kids as what you do when no one else is around. And so we have this discussion on ethics and safety. We've determined that it really needs to take place face-to-face, not in front of a computer. I've got the CARE student handbook with me to hand out. Oregon recognized CARE in 2005 with the passage of HB 2339. No funds were allocated for this, however. If we recognize the need for cyber education, then it is incumbent upon us to fund it. If we don't, then we continue to be part of the problem and not the solution. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Houston. Ms. Cookson.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, thank you for having me here. I am working for WebWise Kids. It's a national nonprofit based in Southern California, but I'm here in the Portland area. Our program is primarily for middle school and high school. We also have a parent program. And we have games. We kind of go away from the lecture format. We want to teach kids in a fun, interactive way where they can see what other teens have done online and maybe see the consequences, but hopefully from seeing other teens' experiences online that they will change their behavior. So our mission statement is to empower youth to make wise choices online. We have our missing game, which is our middle school game, and it's the story of Zach. He's a 14-year-old boy, and it's based on a true story of where he went from British Columbia to California, and he went missing. And the kids start the game where Zach has already gone missing, and they hear the dad's perspective. They hear the law enforcement perspective, and they get to be the detective as they go through each level. They have to figure out clues, and so it's using problem solving and critical thinking, and they go through and try and save Zach. And at the end, sometimes they don't, sometimes they run out of time, and sometimes they do find Zach. But it's an effective game. We had a 15-year-old girl, she's our youth ambassador, where she was living in San Francisco area, and she had a boyfriend online, and he was in West Virginia. And, you know, he's 22, but they were just boyfriend and girlfriend online, and she was in love with him. And he bought a plane ticket to come out to California, and her parents found out. And so they went to an ICAC officer in California and were given a copy of the family kit, which is what this one is, and said, go play this with your kid, with your daughter. You know, don't go lecture to her because you know she'll just run away and go meet him some other way. So here, play this game. And as they played the game, Katie, the girl, she recognized the same exact phrases that her boyfriend had said to her. She's like, that's what he says to me. That's what he promises me. He sends me gifts. And she recognized that her boyfriend might be a predator. And she actually chose, after playing the game, to end the relationship. Well, she thought that was the end of it, but it turned out, as they turned over the evidence to the ICAC, that they were able to find that he had already been meeting a 13-year-old girl in South Carolina. And so Katie ended up flying across country and testifying against him, and he was put in jail for 20 years. So we hope to empower kids by learning what another kid will go through so that they can hopefully avoid those issues. We also have two games for high school. They're called the Cyber Cop series, and they address, someone today said there was a case with Craigslist of the modeling lure, and we have one game called Mirror Image, which is talking about the modeling lure. And then we have Air Dogs, which is more about cyberbullying and piracy. And so we hope to teach with these games in a fun way that they'll think about their actions online.
Thank you, Ms. Cookson. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Ms. Cookson. Now, are those games that you just talked about available through webwisekids.org?
They are. Yes.
Good, because I have 10 grandchildren. We're going to have some little sit-down sessions with Nana.
Good.
Any other questions for this panel? Representative Wisnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I visited my local library, and I'm concerned about some of their policy on the use of the computers, the internet, filters and things. So you support, you know, their policy now, which is not to filter?
I can talk about that. Representative McPherson, Representative Wisenhat. It's very frustrating right now. We've had numerous investigations as of late that have ended at the point where we contact the library and find out that they're not doing anything to to filter what they're doing, and also keep track of who's accessing that computer. And that's a huge problem that we're finding. We need a bill.
Again.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, then I understand there's a video that is pretty. Yeah, why don't we run that?
Sure. This is the video that is called Tracking Teresa.
So, experiment and see. We're starting with Oklahoma, selecting the world's channel. How about one of the videos you sent me for you, like this, about you? Take your address and be currently in the channel. We'll pay water rent. How about Teresa Oklahoma? Only as a fellow channel, we engage Teresa in a private conversation as her age. She should be always giving us that information. Most online or internet service providers have user directories to help their members identify an option maker with similar interests. members can create his own profile of themselves and use a directory for other members to view. While these directories can be used, they can also make you vulnerable. We'll look more information about these by checking the member profile. We try to chat and learn more. Good job, please. She didn't list her age, location, gender, or post a picture of herself, but what does her name tell us? Is she male or female? If her brother's name is Billy Jr., what might her father's name be? If we click on the locate command, we can follow traces wherever she goes in Cybertrace. We can also email or instant message her. After 2 minutes of searching, we have determined that Teresa is most likely a male teen. She likes basketball, music, and hanging out with friends. She has a little brother who most likely answers to Billy Jr. She has a valid email address and an instant messenger account, and we have aggregate addresses for both. Another way to look for information is newsgroup postings. Since we have a valid email address for Teresa, we can use it to search through these postings. Now we have how many messages Teresa has posted, what sites she posted them, and the text of each message. In this posting, she has posted several personal identifiers. Can you find them? They are her telephone number, the time of day she will most likely be home, her mother or sister's name, and her email address. Within 8 minutes, we know that her first name is Teresa. She appears to be in her teens. Her interests are basketball, music, and hanging out with friends. She has a younger brother named Billy Jr. She has valid email and instant messenger accounts. She has a mom or sister named Sue. We have a good idea of what time of day we can find her at home. And we have her home telephone number. How useful is her telephone? Even if we only have her area code, we can use it to quickly get an idea of her geographic location. However, since we have her entire telephone number, let's use it to perform a reverse look and see what else we can find out about Teresa. Searching for the last name of the person Teresa's telephone number is registered to. Our telephone number, let's use it to perform a reverse look and see what else we can find out about Teresa. Searching for the last name of the person Teresa's telephone number is registered to. Most likely Teresa's last name as well. For those of you wondering about your own cell phone numbers right now, there's good news. Most services will allow you to change or eliminate personal data from their directories if you find them. But you have to find the services that list information before you can request them to be removed. As for Teresa, we now have her last name. Same information you can get searching. We'll need another directory. How about the white pages? Every additional piece of information, we can perform more searches. We'll enter her last name and start our next search. I bet we can find out where she lives now that we have her name. There she is. I'm not familiar with that town. Let's see if we can find more information. I'll look at it on the map search. What I'm clicking on there, but I think I like the function look. What if I want to find out how to get there? No problem. I can easily get directions online. Tell me step by step how to get from where I am to where Teresa lives. Now, what about schools? Where does Teresa go to school? That should be pretty easy to narrow down. So let's go to an online search engine and put in the names that can get found that will be most useful to us. Local school. Our search leads to local schools. We can read articles about events in which these schools have been involved. We have street address for schools, but most importantly, we can link to the school's websites. That will allow us to find even more detailed information about the school, such as class times, lunch schedules, and possibly pictures of students. We spent 20 minutes since we first identified Teresa and Jenna. Let your people be discovered about her in the next short time. We know that she's a female teen. We know her full name is Teresa Doe. Her email address is teresa01@email.com. She likes basketball, music, and hanging out with friends. She has a brother named Billy. She collects and portrays music. We know the full names of her mother, father, and brother. We know her home telephone number is 555-888-1212. We know she's probably home by 5:30 p.m. on weekdays. Her mom gets home from work by 5:30. She lives at 111 Liberty Road in Laurel. Wish we were able to give specific directions. And finally, we know what schools are closest to her home. Hopefully, this will make you take a closer look at what you or your children are posting online.
Okay, thank you very much. That's pretty kind of scary to see that kind of information so readily accessible. If there are no further questions, I'd like to excuse this panel, and we have just one more presentation here, just briefly. I'm going to invite up Travis Goldberg and a co-conspirator to describe what they've been doing here during the course of our hearing.
Okay. Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. Again, my name is Travis Goldberg. I'm a detective with the Sheriff's Office. And we were asked prior to this hearing if we would provide a service of doing online chatting undercover while we were doing this hearing. And seated next to me is Deputy Paul Barnstrom. He's a deputy with our office. He went through training with ICE, or Immigration Custom and Enforcement, and by no means do we do this on a full-time basis, and by no means do we consider ourselves experts at this point. We've only had the opportunity of doing a couple of the cyber stings, but he's going to give you a little snippet of about 3 hours spent online chatting during this hearing process.
Thank you, Chairman, and members of the committee. Since about the 3 hours this meeting's been going on, I've been sitting in the back of the room in a chat room chatting with various what could be considered online predators. During that time, I've had approximately 40 contacts with possible predators, 8 of which gave me explicit conversations about wanting to have sex with me, and I was posing as a 13-year-old female in Northeast Portland. 10 of those 38 contacts offered me specific photographs and viewing on their webcams of various acts that they were willing to perform for me. I didn't call them up because I didn't want anybody to walk behind me and see that type of graphic stuff going on. But all I had to do was click a button and I would have been able to see everything they wanted to show me. That was in a nationwide chat room. At some point in the day, the computer kicked me off, probably because of this building. And so I logged back on in a local chat room. And after about 10 minutes, I was contacted by a 20-year-old male. We exchanged photographs, and he was more than willing to meet me after about 10 minutes. And that was one contact that I had, but I did have 5 local contacts in the area that, had I pushed them, I probably could have set up meetings and made some significant investigative steps towards them. The 8 explicit conversations are the ones that fall through the cracks without any online solicitation of minors law currently in the state. These 8 guys were online talking about what they wanted to do with me and to me, and what they wanted me to do to them. But the way the law is now, there is no law that says that's wrong, and that's not an attempted crime at all until they actually make an effort to come to my house or meet me somewhere. So an online solicitation of minors law would allow us to make a move to them before they were able to make a move to us or to somebody else. Thank you for the time.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. I think that really caps off the presentations that were made here earlier today to show just how vulnerable our teenagers are to this kind of relatively sordid activity. So it really, I think, caps off what has been a very informative hearing. I think speaking for the entire committee, we really appreciate everybody who came and presented today, some of them traveling at a great distance, because it certainly enhanced our understanding about the problem and something that we need to deal with. Thank you very much. That concludes all of the presentations for the day. Thank you for traveling to this committee, members. We're adjourned.